The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 27th of September, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Chris Jeffries, Chief Executive Officer of Dev Clever Holdings. That's DEV ticker. And Chris discusses their commercial agreement with the world's number one technology manufacturer and provider to the educational sector, Lenovo, a massive company there in China. Also on the podcast, Glenn Goodman, author of The Crypto Trader, provides some insights into the world of Bitcoin this week and other crypto-related stuff and subjects. Plus, John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talking about Blue Rock Diamonds, Vast Resources, and Keras Resources. Also, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, check them out on the front page of voxmarkets.co.uk, and if you receive an RNS via our app, which is free to download, and you like the contents of that RNS, give it a thumbs up, and it could appear on this podcast, and of course, on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Jeffries, Chief Executive Officer of Dev Clever Holdings. DEV is the ticker there. Thanks very much, Chris, for joining me.
Hi, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. Yes. Very exciting commercial contract you've announced of late, or in fact yesterday, and we'll dig into it. A big name involved, and we'll dig into that in a bit. Just give us, for people listening, Chris, who's never heard of Dev Clever Holdings, just summarise the business, what it's about, please, if you could.
Yeah, sure. We're an innovation digital software house, and we have developed proprietary platforms and softwares in three core channels that we refer to as educate, engage, and experience. And our experience channel is where we produce multi-user virtual reality experiences, which we can use for competitive gaming, or we also use for training, which is more of the growth area of that particular product. Engage is where we've built a proprietary digital incentive management platform, which is we refer to as gamification, and it's a mechanism to help brands and retailers control the exact amounts of digital rewards that can be redeemed in stores on the high street across the world. And then Educate, we have built and developed a revolutionary immersive virtual reality careers guidance platform, which helps young people make informed decisions about their future careers, and then it links them to the relevant colleges or employers that they will then go on to work for in the future.
Yeah, okay, and let's hook into that right now. So you've announced an agreement with Lenovo. Now, that is a massive company, a Chinese-built company. People may have seen their computers around the thing. So take us into what this is all about then, please, if you could, Chris.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, so what we've been doing earlier this year is, as you know, we floated in January. We have then fully finished for the productization of our careers guidance platforms, both the online version Launchpad and the virtual reality version Victor. They were officially launched from April this year. On the build-up from April until now, we've had two key objectives. One was to take them into the marketplace, get lots of visibility, get some early sales off them, and kind of prove that schools, colleges, and employers will want to purchase them as we predicted. And we were very confident about that because we've been building them in collaboration with them exact customer markets for the last 4 years. The second was to then establish the key strategic partnerships that the company needed in order to give us the credibility behind the platform and in order for us to enable the platform to be sent directly to every school across the country. Mm-hmm. So they can then use it and start performing against the government mandated Gatsby benchmarks, which took effect this year. So we successfully secured that partnership, which was with the World Skills Organization, who are a benchmark organization in the country backed by the Department of Education. And they literally deal with every school, institution, FE and HE college, and 250 of the key employers in the UK. And their remit is to bring them all together to develop skills based around careers and apprenticeships and advancing people's educations and career path. So our partnership with them is enables them to put our system at the front of theirs, so that schools and school children can identify what is the right career for them. And then what it's able to do, it is then able to segment all the various colleges and educators and training providers who can support that type of specific career objective in the areas that the young person lives. And that's what Launchpad does. It centralizes all of that data into one big place, and it enables all the people, such as careers leads, who are responsible for recording that information and ensuring that young people remain on their career goals in order to meet their GASP benchmark principles. That's what our system provides them with. Yeah. So as of the 4th of October, mm-hmm. that platform is released to all of them schools across the country. Now, what we will have a very short window of time then, over the next kind of 10 weeks, is to engage directly with as many of them schools as we possibly can do. So the second partnership that was absolutely vital to the success of the company was to partner with a leading manufacturer, somebody who actually makes the physical equipment, and ideally somebody who is dedicated to education and somebody who has the ability to then roll that proposition out to other territories around the world. And we spoke to several interests from some of the biggest technical companies in the world, to be fair, with everyone was really impressed with the virtual reality element of our platform and how efficiently it brought all that information into one central hub. We were pushing with Lenovo, working as close as we can with them and going on to some joint presentations with them to gauge reaction, because Lenovo are obviously the world's biggest provider in the education sector, and they have a whole product which they've dedicated internal resource to developing a VR solution for the future. And it really is the future of learning for all schools across the world. So with the relationship we were able to then form with Lenovo, what it fundamentally means is that if a school purchases our software, they're able to order it directly from us, from any reseller, or it can be sold via the resellers directly into the school. But more importantly, it comes in a box pre-installed on the device. So in terms of supporting that level of rollout and being able to manage the setups and installations, it's all fulfilled as part of that partnership.
Yeah, well, this is like a dream sort of signing for you. Like you said, they are the world's number one technology manufacturer and provider to the educational sector. So ideal. So how, it must have taken a while for them to do their due diligence on you and your product, mustn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So we've been working with them now for, you know, a number of months. We've been doing all sorts of trials. And what we wanted to do is ensure that we weren't looking just solely at the short-term objectives of the UK, because they see that, you know, they very much see the excitement behind our product, which is why we've made a commitment together that we, over the next 90 days, we will be forming that strategy where we will roll this out in collaboration with their products as a complete careers solution for virtual reality across North America and later into Canada.
Yeah, and what's the hope here, Chris? What's the dream you're hoping to achieve with this partnership and hookup here?
So, I mean, obviously we're on a very accelerated timeline as DevClever, and that's simply because we're not a startup company. We started a lot of the pre-development and everything 5-6 years ago. So really now we're at that stage of strategic partnerships and accelerated rollout. So it's making sure we've got the people in the business to support that level of rollout and making sure we've got them strategic partners to support and distribute our clients once the equipment's in situ with them. The dream will be to get critical reach into the USA as well as the UK, secure a huge market sector by 2020, and because we're effectively creating a centralized hub of all of this learning management information, which is all the government predictions of growth and what kind of positions will be available for people to work in. And it has such an impact on what that skills gap will be in the countries. We will then be looking at further integration partners in possibly into major search engines, etc., such like that.
I see. And when do you hope that the moment of course, you're setting the platform here, they're getting it out there, the infrastructure right, you're getting the commercial partners. When are you hoping this will start translating into revenue generation?
So that starts now. Okay. So this is really what we've been building up towards. Was getting everything in place prior to the academic year starting. That started 2 weeks ago. So as of the 4th of October, we then start to, our products are then sent directly to all the schools, in and around the country. Our marketing resource kicks in, our sales strategy kicks in, and it's really about closing down and bringing in that revenue now as quick as we can do. And it's also about securing that audience, because every user on the platform, it's not a short-term use, it's about a program of careers guidance. So as soon as we get the users using the platform, and I think 70,000 people attend the World Skills Show, so school children, what we'll then be looking to do is have a huge influx and input from the colleges and further educators who want to extend that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And more stuff. And so, let's think now, say, in, you know, say 5 years' time, Chris, where do you hope to be with this?
So it's a difficult question, I suppose, to ask, to answer that, because it's certainly what we'll be looking to do is we are forecasting to reach kind of saturation maturity by the end of year three, where we'll have, you know, a significant percentage of all of them territorial markets within the education sector. I think what we will probably be looking more to do then is to strategically partner with other larger companies where we can license some of the technology to be sold in even more diverse locations or horizontals. You know, for example, looking at how the technology can help with the Ministry of Defence, how it can help with problematic youths, and any socially impactful area where virtual reality can help distract and engage somebody in a future career.
Yeah. And at the moment, are you getting some decent feedback from schools and educational places?
It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, the thing is, you said yourself that we are dealing with some huge companies who are very dedicated to innovation in the technology sector within education. Mm-hmm. And they clearly share the vision of what DevClever has, and they see the groundbreaking value in the application of how we're delivering careers information. So it's very exciting times, and we're looking forward to the rest of this calendar year and making a huge impact in education through our UK partnerships.
Yeah, and one other thing, I mean, you know, obviously education is massive, you know, a massive area, huge potential. So there must be competition here, isn't there?
So there is competition. Of course there's competition, and competition can be healthy as well. Mm-hmm. It's our platform, I'd like to think, is truly a unique platform, and there's nothing quite like it. There are lots of different platforms that do little bits of what ours does, but ours is all built around the user experience. And it's all made really simple, and it's all in one place. It's a system that doesn't have to only be used in schools. It can be used independently. And it means that anything that happens with your careers advisors, when you're looking at what colleges or employers that you're thinking about working for, you can then research them through the same platform with your parents and influencers at home. Because obviously, without being in the sector, it's the parents are very concerned about what happens to their children and, you know, the next steps they take. And again, platform is a great launchpad, is a great way to help communicate that information clearly and concisely to parents and influencers.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous stuff. Okay, Chris, well, three final things to do. If someone's listening right now, looks a sound of what you're doing here but are not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please?
Absolutely. So with the new academic year starting, we have geared ourselves up perfectly to secure a large section of the educational market in the UK. We, with our recent partnerships, we have a direct route to market to roll our products out across North America in 2020. And we are fully developed and our product is out in the market and we are generating revenue from it.
Marvellous stuff. Chris, good to chat to you as always, and no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, whose goal was to retire young and wealthy, escaping from the daily grind. He taught himself how to trade everything from shares to Bitcoin and made enough money to realise his dream to quit his day job while he was still in his 30s. That's weight, 30 stone, that is, of course. And now he's 40 stone and he's richer, and every time he puts on 10 stone he adds an extra 10 million. He just finds weight and money go together well, and it also helps with his food habit. Only joking, Glenn's a slim looking fella, a good looking fella with
svelte,
and he's a crypto trader. Well, last week I was saying what a long time a week is in the world of crypto, because last week I was saying Bitcoin is boring coin. It's not doing anything. And we did say for a long time, I said that channel on the chart, I pointed out the channel, it looks like we said it's a continuation pattern maybe going up. It didn't. It broke lower, and when it actually broke that downward support level, God, did it break it. And I described it actually in my weekend on my video yesterday, or by chart, saying it's like someone walking across their attic, forgetting the attic door was open, you know, inside their attic, and then falling straight through the floor. Because it was a big drop, wasn't it? About 20% in like, 6 sessions. But I mean, in one day, it dropped, $1,000?
More than that, yeah. And what's kind of reassuring about it, Justin, from our point of view, me and you, is that, as you say, we've been kind of talking about this for weeks and weeks. We've been anticipating it effectively. We'd said,
a move.
Okay, it's forming this, it's forming this triangle pattern and it's moving in a tighter and tighter range towards a point, towards an apex. And what it did, I mean, it did what these charts often do, which is make three attempts to break down over the month, over the 3 months that the triangle was forming. It made three solid attempts, and it's always the rule of threes tends to work so often, because of course all of this is driven by human nature and human psychology, and humans for some reason seem to love the rule of threes. So when it got to the third attempt to break down through that triangle, it worked. So personally, I mean, I know this isn't your kind of method of trading, but I went short.
He's called it again. Glenn has called it again. He went short.
You can find all the details in my book, The Crypto Trader, out now at all reputable bookshops. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, yeah, I talk about shorting in the book because it's not something I love doing, to be honest. I prefer to be long. And the main reason I prefer to be long is because the upside is infinite, whereas the downside, you can only go as far as zero.
100%, 100% downside, that's all you can do, and you can do several 100% upside. So the risk is essentially lower than the reward, isn't it? But you should always minimise your exposure, not maximise exposure, of course. Yeah, so...
But on the odd occasion, I like to go short when the sign is so damn obvious that you can make money out of it.
Are you still short?
No, I closed my shorts, so I made a nice profit.
Do you know what? That gave me an odd image in my mind, then you closing your shorts. I'm glad you did close the shorts. Come on, Glenn, put it away. No, but because do you know what? Like I said, you're right. We did look at this. We said, isn't that where? Just, once it breaks, we didn't know which way it was going to go, of course, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, really, as long as if you do short and long. But it did break, and I did tweet, it was when it was still falling heavily on a couple of days ago. I said, I made one wrong prediction. I said, okay, 200-day moving average, that's where it's going. I'm going to bed, good night, that's what it's about. And it is on that 200-day moving average, isn't it? It's round about using that as support. So who knows where it'll go. What's your thoughts from here then?
Right, well, my thoughts were, first of all, people are obviously speculating, why on earth did this happen? I mean, from my point of view...
Why on earth did it happen?
Well, I think I already know why it happened. It happened because, as we said, human psychology, a triangle moving towards its apex, it gets almost there, and then the price has to break out one way or the other, because that's what happens when you get towards the point of a triangle. It's got nowhere else to go. So I'm saying that it was kind of inevitable, and it doesn't matter what the news is. But, of course, people always want a proper explanation. They want to look in the news to find a reason. Now, one thing that had been playing on my mind for several days before this happened was Google's there was a leak of a special document from Google, which was very quickly removed from wherever it was posted, but it was there long enough for people to know about quantum computing. Did you see this thing?
Apparently they're doing it with NASA, and didn't NASA publicize it or something and pull it back, or someone from NASA put it up there somewhere, so, and then they withdrew it. So quantum computing, so tell us why this is significant to crypto.
Right, because in this paper, Google said it had created a quantum computer that solved an equation in 3 minutes 20 seconds. This equation would take IBM's best supercomputer 10,000 years to complete. And this Google quantum computer apparently did it in 3 minutes 20 seconds. Now, this matters because Bitcoin and all cryptocurrencies rely completely on cryptography. They rely on amazingly complex codes that are impossible to break. That's what makes Bitcoin secure, hence the crypto bit in the name. But quantum computers are the big threat to cryptocurrencies, because if you can solve a calculation that much more quickly, then potentially you could crack Bitcoin and steal everybody's money. That's the problem. So that's what was playing on my mind, right? Yeah. And that's why I thought maybe it could have helped push the price all the way down as it did. But having said that, since then, lots of proper quantum computing experts have come out and said, actually, this is nowhere near as significant as it looks. It was a very bespoke experiment set up by Google in order to do this specific calculation, and actual quantum computing on a commercial level that would be able to crack cryptocurrencies, cryptography, is still many, many years away, is what the experts are saying.
Yeah, well, I had someone tweet me that article, right, saying when Bitcoin was falling, and this guy said, well, I sold all my cryptocurrency because of this, and he sent me that article about Google, and I said, yeah, but it's going to take a long time, even Google are not admitting it yet, they've done it, so, you know, by the time they get to commercial levels, surely it's going to be, you know, years.
What's more, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are going to improve their cryptography in the meantime, obviously, in order to account for this. So the suggestion I've heard from one quantum computing expert that I spoke to a while back, he said, look, even if quantum computing can crack it within, say, a decade, cryptocurrencies are improving and expanding their capabilities as well, so they'll be able to kind of keep ahead of the quantum computing curve.
And who's to say someone like Google won't get involved with helping, you know, the crypto side of the security side of cryptocurrencies as well, knowing with their knowledge, so they could put their input and say this is how to make it less crackable in a way. And of course, we have no idea what they cracked. We have no idea the question, like you say, what they cracked and how it relates in any way in similarity to how cryptocurrencies are. So it could be way off, you know? It's ridiculous, really. It's like saying, we've discovered a way of flying in an experiment, a human, you know, and then actually get to reveal what actually happened and what you've done. You've managed to make a little ant fly for a half a second or something, you know. So, you know, the reality of what's happened and the experiment is way off. And like I said, they're not even admitting it themselves. So, you've got to say it's questionable. But
I wonder why it got leaked.
So what do you reckon? I mean, do you think, though, now we're going to have you know, because if you look at what I look at in situations like this, when people think it's going to go lower, if you look at the RSI, right, it's really oversold. It's down at 22. Now, if you look back, the last time that happened was when a big sell-off happened. It came back off its highs, but then it went down. It's about 6,000 Bitcoin, and then went down below 20. And in fact, from then, it went down to, say, 3,000. It's sort of halved. They bowed back up and then came back around. I don't think it'll have that big a fall, because it didn't rise that aggressively as in last time. It went to $20,000. This time it's gone to 13. So I don't think it'll have that big a fall, but I think we've still got room for a bit more downside, do you?
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching it carefully because even though I've closed my short trade, I would possibly consider reopening it if there's another plunge.
I should have reopened your shorts on another plunge, you didn't.
Or I would also consider going long if I think of... Yeah, getting even longer.
Everything's an innuendo here, isn't it?
That's the kind of show you're running here.
Yeah, sorry. That's my mind, not yours, sorry.
Looking at the chart over the past couple of days since it plunged, it's forming a base. Now, that base could work well either way because it seems nice and consistent. It's, you know, the chart's kind of moving along in a nice sideways way. And when that happens, I mean, it's impossible to call. It could plunge again or it could go up and form two walls, which often happens as well, you know, where you get a plunge on one side and then it goes along sideways for a bit and then it shoots upwards again and you get like two walls on either side, sort of parallel lines. And that's usually a very bullish sign when that happens. So I'm kind of looking out for either one to happen. I'm happy to go long. I'm happy to go short. As a trader, what I like is big, fast movement. Yes. And obviously that's what I got the other day. It took 3 months of waiting. And as usual, this is the curse of traders, really, in a way, is that you never feel like you've got enough money on when there's a really good trade, but you've always got too much on when it turns out to be a bad trade that goes wrong. It just happens to traders all the time. It's probably in our minds, but it's so frustrating. And this was another one of those cases. Even though me and you had been anticipating it breaking out fast in one direction or another for about 3 months, when it eventually happened, I didn't have the courage of my convictions, I guess, to really go for it and make myself super rich within the space of 5 minutes. So, you know, I made a decent profit. I can't complain, but I was still frustrated and like, oh, why didn't I stick more money on? So the question, and then what happens to traders, another psychological problem is that after you've not put enough on, now that we're watching this curve go sideways, the price go sideways, and I'm anticipating another big breakout, either upwards or downwards, no doubt this time I'll put more money on because I'll be right, I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. But the second movement after a big movement is often quite disappointing. So I could actually find myself putting too much money on next time. Sod's law, mate.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. I mean, you know, it's always the case. We always start to, you know, when trade works, you think, oh, I should put more on. When it goes wrong, I should put less on. So yeah. Really, you know, it's good to have those thoughts because it's sort of in the middle somewhere. It's fine. And like I say, it's all about exposure. You don't want to go badly wrong, you know. But there we are. Yeah, it's glad to see a bit of excitement. And do you know what? Like I said, I had the same thought that you had. I thought, even though I don't go short, I don't trade. I'm only like Bitcoin because I have exposure via this blockchain company that's mining, one of the most efficient miners. I don't care. They're profitable at $2,000 of Bitcoin. Yeah. So I'm happy. Even though their share price is leveraged to that, it'll move with Bitcoin. I'm only looking at Bitcoin. So I don't trade it. But what I thought, like you said, I was glad that I had that sort of trend line in there. And when it broke it, it really moved. So that was right. So I said, no, it seems like technical analysis does work then. You know,
cause, it really
you know,
does.
Sometimes I, you know, things happen and charts. And you can't explain it. And there's no news out for some reason. A share price moves and it doesn't conform to any kind of TA you think of, you know?
Yeah.
But this did conform, fair play. And it's even conformed on stopping on the 200-day moving average. So it does conform very well.
And the amazing thing is that it conformed even though, you know, not just us. We weren't the only people who were talking about this triangle. You know, the whole crypto community, because it had been forming for 3 months, it was inescapable. Anybody could see it with a naked eye. You don't even need to draw lines on the charts. So everybody was expecting this chart to break out either up or down, and so you would kind of think that if everybody's expecting something, then it can't possibly happen. Surely, you know, something should happen that surprises everybody. But it didn't. It happened exactly the way the textbooks show.
And do you know what? Like I said before, it's hard to avoid ranges because you know you're in the middle, you're in no man's land. You know, it's not overcooked, it's not oversold. And at the moment now, I quite like it, because what we've got here is an oversold position. So the probability exists that there, you know, there's more, as long as we stay down here for a little bit longer, then there's a greater chance it'll go up, you know, rather than being in no man's land, being in the middle of nowhere. Because like I said, the RSI is right down there. And if you look back, it hasn't been down there since, November last year. So like I said, we are now at an extreme. And that means it should revert to mean somewhere. And so therein lies an opportunity, you know. So I quite like that.
In the short term, yeah. I mean, let's zoom out and look at the big picture, because people always want to know, right, well, where's Bitcoin going now in the long run?
Are you talking literally zoom out on the chart? Are you talking literally zoom out on the chart, or literally not, just figuratively speaking? What are you saying?
I mean both, I think. Okay. I'm literally, as we speak, I'm physically zooming out on the chart that I'm looking at.
Let me do that.
But I'm also zooming out in my thinking here. I'm also zooming out to look at the big picture. And the big picture is a tricky one, but I'll show you why, because there are two possibilities, as ever. There's always two sodding possibilities, and one of them is that this is a temporary breakdown in the upward movement, the bull market that began in April this year. Because let's not forget that Bitcoin quadrupled in price between April and June, which was tremendous, and it has fallen a fair bit since then now, but it's still hung on to most of those gains. We've still got the majority of those gains, so you could still see this as just a correction within that same bull market, and that it will, as you say, that perhaps it's oversold and that it will pick up from here and or from around here somewhere, and you know, go on to carry on that upward trend, right? That's one way of looking at it. But there is another way that's bugging me right in the back of my brain the whole time, a possibility that actually the bear market that began, the massive bear market that began when Bitcoin crashed at the beginning of 2018 from a price of $20,000, maybe that bear market never ended, Justin. Maybe this is just a continuation of that, and that this triangle that we've been looking at here is just a small part of a much larger triangle that has been forming ever since 2016.
Okay, well, let me look at the I'm looking at the monthly charts. You know, that's a big rise that we've had recently. Yeah, which you know, yeah. If you look at monthlies and weeklies.
Yeah, look at the monthly.
We're still sort of in a, like I said, RSI. Yeah.
Can you see what I mean when you're looking at the monthly? That is part of that same bear market. That this is just a, like another attempt to reach that high peak of 20,000 that failed, and that you know, and then we continue to trade within a range for maybe another year or something like that.
Yeah.
Is that? Can you see that possibility?
I don't like
the possibility because it's kind of boring, but. Yeah. But it's possible. But having said that, the good thing about that is that if this is all part of the same bear market that, say, continues on for another 6 months, a year, something like that, before this massive triangle pattern has finished forming, what happens with those, and you see it, for example, in the gold market, that when and in precious metals, is that when you get a massive pattern forming over several years like that, then when it eventually does break out, then real excitement can begin and you can be looking at absolutely massive upward price targets, you know, for Bitcoin, that would be $100,000 or higher, you know, even $500,000. You know,
Glenn Goodman says Bitcoin could hit 500,000. Go for a million, Glenn. Listen, if you're going for a figure, go for a million. Don't pussyfoot around on the half a million. I mean, you're almost there. I know, say it right now. Bitcoin's going to a million bucks.
No, I don't want to be one of those people.
I
hate those people who say it's going to a million by the end of the year, because they were all saying it in 2018. So many of these commentators on CNBC and so on.
But they
realize they're always wrong.
What's it called? I read about it, and basically, you're going to fail big, you know, because people don't remember small failures. So if you're going to fail, make a big statement. So if you do get it right, you'll be regarded as a genius. If you get it wrong, right, people pretty much forget about it. They don't keep harping on about it all the time. But and then you can delete all your tweets that got it wrong, and then you just say, look, I said this back then. So, you know.
That's true. You delete all your tweets apart from the one
genuine.
You delete all the false ones. They do that, don't they?
Have you ever heard of the guy called Dr. Doom? Dr. Doom, you know?
Nouriel Roubini, the economist.
He's calling for a recession every 6 months, pretty much, okay? Now, you know, like a stopwatch, it's right twice a day, pretty much. But with him, sooner or later, he'd be spot on. He'd say, I'll be calling this for the last 6 months, like the last year. So he did that with the financial crash. Now, people say about him, oh, he predicted the financial crash. Hang on, he was predicting the financial crash like 5 years previously to that. So, of course, he's going to be right sooner or later because you have cycles. You know, these cycles last for 5 and 10 years. So, you know, if you keep saying the same thing over and over, you keep saying the Bitcoin will hit, you know, $50,000 or $100,000, yeah, and it probably will, you know, in a few years' time. So,
I was one of those people myself back in my young and stupid days when I was a TV and radio reporter, you know, doing business correspondent type guy for BBC and ITV. When I basically said, I was convinced the housing market was overvalued, which of course it was, and that therefore it would crash. See, these were back in the days when I thought if something was overvalued, that meant it had to crash pretty soon. I was saying from about the year 2000 onwards, this housing market, you know, it's got to crash pretty soon. Yeah. And so I kept saying it and kept saying it. And eventually I was right, what, about a decade later. So I was one of those stopped clock people who got it wrong for a decade and then eventually got it right.
Yeah, well, do you know what? Macro, it's so hard. It is like a super tanker. And literally, you know, it can be, you know, going one way, seemingly going one way, for a long time before it actually falls off a cliff, you know? And I've come completely out of the market nearly on stock shares, been up to 80% in cash and then gone back in the last year or so, because I'm convinced it was going to fall off the cliff. I'm there again now. I'm 60% cash now. But I do believe, and I still think it could be another year and before we get to the final sell-off, big sell-off. Because at the moment, look at the S&P 500. It's like within 1% of its all-time high. And I think, really?
Yeah.
Is our economy that good? We're that close to the all-time highs? I just think we're setting ourselves up for a big fall. And I really do. I think they're really high risk at the moment. And yet we've got global growth problems. We've got trade deals. We've got Brexit. We've got Europe slowing down. And yet, which 0.5% off from the high of the all-time market. You know, it's ridiculous.
Well, I'm one of those people who thinks that the interest rate accounts for all of this. The low interest rates all over the world pushing everybody's money into assets. You know, assets that have any kind of a return and any kind of a yield. And so stocks, even American stocks, after how much they've risen, some of them still produce really good yields. So from that point of view, it's a good thing for sort of pension fund managers and that kind of thing to be putting their money in that market still, even at these dizzy heights, because interest rates are so pathetic otherwise. I think that's the main reason, and interest rates are only going one way at the moment, which is down, which would kind of imply that stock markets may still have some way to run on the upside.
I agree, but I think, you know, do you know what, it's like the old thing, buy low and sell high is quite hard because it's all relative. But if you look at Bitcoin now on a daily level chart, it's oversold. But you can go to a weekly, and it's not that oversold. So hang on, go back to a weekly and say, wait until it's oversold on a weekly. Then maybe, you know, if you're a trader, start thinking, right now I can start getting into it. I mean, if you're a long-term or investor, whatever, you can't invest in Bitcoin really. But I'm supposed to. Can you invest in Bitcoin, do you think? I mean, if you're an early investor, maybe.
I mean, there are a lot of people who, called the HODLers, as I talk about in the book. The HODLers, H-O-D-L, stands for Hold On For Dear Life. And this is a
drunken tweet
in the Bitcoin world. Yes, that's right.
That says everything. It's like, you know, came from a muddled mind.
Came from a drunken tweet, but the idea of hodling is like a religion. It's like, it doesn't matter how much Bitcoin falls, just carry on holding. Hold it until, you know, I know people personally who have put their life savings into it and are prepared to hold it until zero. And I mean, I can't get into that mindset at all. I think that's almost crazy. But I'm actually talking about quite intelligent people. But it's like they've bought into that idea and they think that that is a gamble worth taking. And actually, the reason they think that's a gamble worth taking is because of this exact thing we just mentioned about shorting earlier on, about how the upside is infinite, but the downside is finite, right? Mm-hmm. So the way that one guy I'm thinking of in particular is looking at it is that if he loses his life savings, then he loses his life savings and that's bad, but he can make more money, you know, he's got a good job, he can make more money, blah blah blah. Whereas if he's right and he's put his life savings into Bitcoin and say it does go from its current level of around about, what is it, about almost 8,000, 8,500, if it does go all the way up to $500,000 or $1 million or whatever, then his life savings have turned him into one of the world's billionaires. So he thinks that's a gamble worth taking. Personally, personally, I don't have anything like that level of iron stomach, but he does, so, you know, good luck to him.
Well, exactly. Why didn't he consider just putting half his life savings in, and then he'd be half broke if it goes wrong? But, yeah, he's overexposing it a little bit. Marvellous.
Just a little. A tiny bit.
Marvellous, Glenn, good to chat to you in the world of crypto, as always. And like I said, is the book still selling? Am I still getting my 0.1 of a Bitcoin commission?
It's selling like hot cakes, my friend. Yeah, it is. And I'm going to be speaking at a bunch of conferences. I don't know if I should mention the names of them on air. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, go on then.
Well, there's the London Investor Show, which some of your listeners will, I'm sure, have gone to, because it's on every single year, the London Investor Show.
If you see Glenn
Hammersmith in October.
Hammersmith October. Hang on a second. Let me say one thing. If you are going to the Hammersmith, what is it? Hammersmith Apollo? It's not called that anymore, is it?
No. What's it called? No, this is a big hotel in Hammersmith.
Hammersmith Investor Show. If you go there and you see Glenn
London
there, just to let him know you heard him on the podcast, just call him Len, all right? Say, good to hear you on the podcast, Len. And I think, you know, I think you've moved on and you're looking remarkable after Strictly. The telly put so many years...
Len. I hate that Len.
The telly put so many years on you. You look a lot better in real life, a lot younger. A lot more vibrant. Obviously, crypto is agreeing with you. Yeah, dancing didn't for some reason, which is odd.
Damn that Len.
So Hammersmith's Investor Show. Where else then?
London Investor Show. It's called. It's on every year. Not every year. There's a special code to get in free through me, and I'm trying to remember what on earth it is. Hold on.
It's Len.
I'll tell you. It is
Len
the
BTC.
Special code. It is Goodman19. Okay. It's all one word, Goodman19. So if you go to the London Investor Show, and the tickets usually cost £25, and then it'll ask you, stick in your special voucher code. If you put in Goodman19, all one word, not case sensitive, then you will get in free. And it gives you a plus one, I think, as well. So you would get, say, £50, you get two complimentary tickets with Goodman19.
Let's be honest. There are no crypto traders out there, that do have a plus one.
It's not crypto traders. This is the London Investor Show.
They don't have any friends.
It covers stocks and shares mainly, but it's got a separate cryptocurrency stage this year, which I'll be speaking on, and also I'll be doing in a crypto panel discussion on the main stage as well.
All I'm saying is I doubt whether the majority of your fan base have anyone but themselves they can take along. I just think they're quite a lonely crowd.
That's all you wanted to say, was it? You had to come back to that just to make your dig about crypto people.
Yeah, yeah.
You had to do it.
I know.
All right, I can't deny it.
It wasn't even a joke. It was so weak, I shouldn't have gone back to it. But
it's kind of fair enough. Who can deny it? It's the intersection between finance and technology. So, yes, it very much attracts
a certain
type of person, shall we say. Yeah, I can't deny it. But personally, I just want to make it clear to the listeners, I have got a wife. I pulled a woman and I married her. So I'm not one of those people. Just wanted to point that out, that's all.
So you say. Right, marvellous stuff, Glenn. Thanks for that, fella. And we'll catch up next week.
Good. Looking forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You all right, John?
Yes, I'm good. Thank you.
Now, we got a bit of a sort of a bling episode here, because we're talking about diamonds and gold, pretty much, the companies we're talking about. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. It's a diamond morning, that's for sure.
I don't know anything about diamonds too much. I'm not that au fait with diamond mining. It's a bit tricky. It's not as well known, is it, as other kinds of mining, gold mining. Diamonds are a bit more specialist, isn't it?
Well, diamonds are at the fun end of the scale from a mining perspective. Diamond mines are relatively simple. It's a bit tricky in terms of the risk of discovering diamonds is greater. So they're not easy to find. It's not easy to find proper diamondiferous kimberlite pipes. But once you've got one, and once you've discovered that it's a gem quality diamond diamond pipe or diamond mine. The processing is relatively simple. The recovery rates are also quite simple and definitely improving over the years. And I mean, we always used to say it was a 1 in 50 chance of finding a diamondiferous kimberlite pipe, and then a 1 in 50 chance of that kimberlite pipe being of economic quality.
Wow.
Blue Rock.
A 2,500 to 1 chance.
Yeah, I mean, look, these are gross approximations, but that's kind of what the industry works on.
You wouldn't bet a horse for that odds, would you?
No, right. You wouldn't. No. But it is better than a lottery ticket, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right there. Do you know what? I don't know what. If I forget, I've got a direct debit that I pay the lottery, and I didn't realise it did. Every now and again, though, a ticket comes through on email saying, you've won a lucky dip, which is basically the chance to have another go. Like, what's the point of that? And all that does is win another lucky dip another month in the line. So, yeah, keeps me in the game, I suppose. But it's probably, in fact, I get pretty better odds there than finding a diamond. But so anyway, diamond companies, who's released some news then, John?
Blue Rock Diamonds have reported that they've discovered yet another large gem quality. Well, they haven't said if it's gem quality, but it's a large diamond of just over 20 carats. And back in June, July, they discovered a 24 carat diamond, and they've had quite a number of good sized stones this year. So I'm impressed by what's coming out of this plant, and a lot of it's down to new management, some improvements to the mining process, definite improvements to the processing plant and the recovery of these larger stones. The last one that they sold was for $190,000, it's all going a lot better for them.
How much is 20 carats? Oh, hang on, I'm looking on the timeline. They got 10.6 carat diamonds sold for $103,000. So 20 carats, it will be roughly twice that then, I suppose.
Well, look, it so much is down to the quality of that stone and the colour of that stone.
Yeah.
But, you know, one can easily get quite excited. The last stone they sold was 25 carats, and they sold it for $190,000.
Okay.
So my guess is that this stone is going to sell for something between $50,000 and $250,000. Now, okay, that's a big range. But it's going to be a valuable stone. It's quite likely to get maybe $150,000, and that's good news, because they are finding they're finding larger stones, and they're finding them more regularly and more often. And statistically, that says to me that there's a lot more coming in. Now, it's possible they could be in a part of the mine that has a higher grade and some better quality stones, but I think this is more about just improving the whole process. And you've got a guy called Mike Houston in there who's running the plant. He's a fantastic guy in the mining industry. He turned around Shanta Gold, and he's doing it again here.
Yeah, okay. So I'm working at, obviously it depends on the quality, like you say, but around about 10 grand a carat. It's an expensive vegetable. But there we are. Okay, cool. What's the other company then we look at with diamonds involved?
Diamonds, Vast Resources.
Oh, yeah, right, they rose. The share price went nuts yesterday. And it's up today as well. So it's up like 80% yesterday, I think it was, or 50%, and then it's up to another 20% today.
So they have an agreement they have a subsidiary called Katanga, and they have an agreement with the local tribe, or the trust representing the local tribe, and the ZCDC, the Zimbabwean Diamond Mining Company, which represents the Zimbabwean government interests. And they're going into the Marange diamond fields. There's a section of those diamond fields that have not been mined in the past. And so they have the rights to go in there and start mining alluvials in this area. The thing about Marange, it has been fabulously rich in the past. I mean, we don't know exactly how rich, but it was rich enough for the Chinese army to move in there one day. I'm not quite sure exactly under what guise that was. So there has been trouble at Marange over the years, because when you get diamond fields that are this rich, people always want to have a piece of it. So the good thing is,
yeah. When did they move in? The Chinese army. When was this? What time? What decade were we talking about?
This was a few years ago, and in fact, a representative of the Zimbabwean government went to have a look at things some years ago and got turned away by a bunch of Chinese soldiers. So the story has it. Which upset the Zimbabwean government a lot.
Well, and it would wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yes, they then cleared the Chinese out, mm-hmm. and Global Witness were involved and things like that. I mean, effectively, diamonds were being stolen from the Zimbabwean nation.
Yeah.
Things have been cleaned up over there, and Vast Resources have the rights to go into a small area of this that is away from where the trouble was before. And to start, hopefully, recovering diamonds quite soon.
Yeah, there hasn't been, in many respects, there hasn't been a happy relationship between the Chinese and, commercialising Africa, has there? There's been lots of tales of woe and, bad treatment, basically, not respectful treatment, of the communities. I don't know if that's sort of, obviously, I'm generalising that a bit. Of course, there are some fantastic relationships and partnerships going on. But generally, it's been looked upon with a furrowed brow, isn't it?
Well, the Chinese have their own way of doing things. They like to employ lots of Chinese labor that they bring over. Sometimes that labor may have come out of Chinese labor camps. But the fact is, they don't really integrate that much with the locals. They don't like employing and teaching the locals, and the locals naturally get a little bit upset about that. And we've heard some pretty horrendous stories over the years of relations between Chinese and local communities really not working well. And also, the locals get a bit upset because the Chinese eat a lot of the wildlife. And sometimes
what?
That's the sort of wildlife
really?
We might not eat.
I didn't realise that.
They like the lizards and the snakes and all that sort of stuff. So,
wow, I didn't realise. I didn't expect that it can be coming. I mean, I understand there's been a lot of tales of exploitation there, because it's true. Let's be honest. If China were going to build or going to build a factory over here in the UK, you'd generally welcome it because you think, of course, lots of local employment. Now they just brought over loads of Chinese people to work in the factory and nobody was locally employed, then you think, well, what's the benefit of that? So you can understand why, there's this antagonistic relationship there if they're doing that. Cool, so that's Vast. Obviously, they'll be treating them with respect. They're Vast. In fact, I chatted to Andrew quite a few times and he said quite a few meetings with the, community elders there, and you have to be very respectful,
And Andrew's a good man for this. He's sensitive to the locals. He's passionate about running the business. He's turning Vast Resources around, which hasn't been an easy job. He's working with the assets in Romania. And that's all looking quite interesting. So I'm a big fan of Andrew. He's dedicated, he gets it, and he seems to be the right man for the job.
Yeah, you're right. It hasn't been an easy job, and I think he's taken a bit of flack from shareholders because, of course, like I said, it's not hard, easy, is it? Especially working in the jurisdictions he's working in, Romania and Zimbabwe. It's not easy places to work, So he has had a bit of an issue there, but I think, like I said, he is doing the right thing, I think. Slowly, but it's a slow... It's always... things like this always take longer than they... When you turn the company around and taking over a company and trying to, do the right thing, it can take a lot longer than people expect, especially the shareholders,
Yeah, and he's had to deal with some legacy issues left to him from other directors, which he's had to sort of get over. Clean up the balance sheet is the key thing, and actually push the company ahead. And it's working. It's getting there, or at least we hope so.
Yeah, cool. Anything else happening there? Or gold?
Well, Keras Resources. This is an unusual situation because Keras has a market capitalization of £11 million. Mm-hmm. And they own £11 million of shares, worth of shares, in an Australian-listed gold exploration company called Calidus Resources.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to demerge the Calidus shares. So every investor in Keras on a certain date in November is going to be qualified for and be given shares of equal value in Calidus, which they may or may not choose to sell. My advice would be to hang on to those shares, firstly, because if everybody tried to sell them, the shares would not do so well. And second, I think Calidus actually has a good future in Australia because they have a couple of sensible projects there. The value on those, I'm sure, will increase going forwards, assuming that the gold price holds up. And I think Calidus is going to do quite good things. So for me, I think Keras investors should just put those shares away in a bottom drawer and cross their fingers and hope that the Togo government gives Keras the mining permit for the Nagea manganese mine that they've developed. The machinery is sitting there. Everything is ready to go. As soon as that mining permit arrives, they'll start mining. And that has almost equivalent value to the value of the Calidus share. So for me, I think that's why most investors own Keras resources. And I think that's, you know, that hopefully will be value adding quite soon.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. KRS is ticker there. And when do you have to be on the register? It says here, currently anticipated for those intentions to merge, held by care to distribute them from as the shareholders, are currently anticipated to be those on the register 6 p.m. 19th of November, 2019.
Yeah.
Is that right?
So you need to own the shares on that date, and then you effectively qualify for a Calidus share of equal value to the one that you already own.
Cool. Well, all right. Well, all the stuff. Marvellous stuff. Thank you for that, John. And we'll catch up next week, fella.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five. Feedback. That's FDBK up 11.6% to 1.2 pence. At four, SafeStay. Flat to date, 33.5 pence. At three, Metro Bank. It was down, but now it's flat. 166. MTRO ticker there. At two, IQAI, and that's up 65% at the moment. They've had approval from the FDA for Stonechecker. And number one, most liked or most followed company, I should say, is Vast Resources, up 17.5%, and they were up massively yesterday too. And of course, we talked about them on the podcast there with John. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, it is C4X Discovery interim results. At four, Solo Oil interim results. At three, ECR business update. At two, that's ECR Minerals. Fast Forward Innovations investee company update. Fralis Leap Gaming. I don't know what that means. Leap Gaming is one of the investees. And at number one, Anglo African Oil and Gas half year report. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.